So here's the thing, right? So we want to have this great cloud of witnesses, but it's hard work to make this out. Like, so we need to be in communities where we are like actively seeking to be with people who are not the same as us. That's hard to do, right? This is hard to do. That's number one. Therefore, since there's a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off the sin that so easily entangles us. Now, one of the translations of the word, the sin that so easily entangles, uses the word, the sin that so easily distracts us. Here's something to know. All sin begins with distraction. All sin begins with a distraction of my attention. We talked last night about the attentional mechanism. We like to say that attention is the ignition key of the mind. Everything that we do, that we do, happens because there's been a shift in my attention. How well am I paying attention to what I'm paying attention to? One would have wondered, were Adam to have been paying attention to what the snake was saying to his wife, he could have said, excuse me, I'd like to have God come be part of this conversation. But somebody wasn't paying attention to this. But what the text says, therefore, since we've had this cloud of witnesses, they're bearing witness, let us throw off the sin. And here's the thing. It's really hard for us who are so well-healed, who are so effective educationally and economically, it's really hard for us to have somebody else say no to us. It's hard for me to say no to somebody else. We don't like we want what we want. I want what I want. Like, I'm speaking for myself. Like, I want what I want. Why is it? I don't get this. If God has this tree from which he doesn't want them to eat in the Garden of Eden, If I'm God and I don't want them to eat of this, I'm like, guys, 40 miles to the west, I've put a tree, it's surrounded by brambles and thorns. If you come upon it, you just won't want to take a look at it. It's not a big deal. But if you, like, don't eat of the fruit of that tree. No, he doesn't, like, he plants it where? In the center of the garden. He plants it right in the, like, in the town square. He plants this most beautiful tree with lots of fruit and says, no. I'm like, that's lunacy. Like, and I want to suggest to us that it is representative of the reality that there are many things, we all in here have different things about which we would say is the core of our identity. The very thing that I want the most. And I want to suggest that, like, it is that very thing to which God will consistently say no. Because in choosing that core thing rather than choosing Jesus, that core thing will become my death sentence. If we're going to heal shame, one of the important things that we have to recognize is that there are things that we each carry around with us that we don't really want to give up. There is sin that is at the core of my identity. I don't mean just sins. I don't mean just like things I do. I mean who I hold myself to be, that I hold on to which Jesus says, no, you can't have that. That's mine and mine alone. I am the only one to hold the space in you about which your life will revolve, because in the day that you make it somebody something else, like, you're going to die. It's not, this is not a God who says, no, you can't have that space because I want it and I'm insecure enough that I'm going to make sure that I'm the only one that gets it. No, this is a God who said, like, look, I know what makes you work. I know how you flourish. And I know that if you're going to, like, turn away from me and each other, it's going to kill you. And so it's going to be important for us that in the very center of who we are, there will be things that I just assume, of course I want and of course I should have. That's just who I am. Whether it's my sexuality, whether it's my eros, whether it's my job, whether it's my relationships, whether it is my whatever it is, we've all got something that will repeatedly come back to us over and over and over. And if there's something that God has helped you say no to effectively, something else will quickly be moving in to take its place. Because evil is not going quietly into the night. Therefore, let us throw off all the sin that distracts and entangles. And of course, part of being in a group of people who bear witness to my life, I'm going to have to be open to them identifying what some of those things are, as well as myself identifying what some of those things are, right? Let us throw off those things and run with perseverance the race set before us. Perseverance. There may not be a more important word in the New Testament. There may not be a more important word. Practice, 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 practice. Neuroplastic change happens most effectively because we practice it over and over and over and over again. If we want our brains to change, the most effective way to do it is to practice small things multiple times rather than practicing one thing just one time. So if I want to become good at playing the piano, and if I'm not like playing 8 hours a day, it's going to be far better for me to play 15 minutes a day for 6 days a week than to play for 3 hours once a week. I'm far better at that. What are the things that we are having a hard time practicing? Practicing saying no to things, right? I mean, anybody who's been in recovery, right? If you've been in the rooms, right? You know that like you're practicing recovery all day, every day until you're dead, right? This is what we do. We practice this. Now, here's the thing about perseverance, though. It is true that the more we practice, the more effective we become. It's really true. The more we practice, the better we get. Run the race of perseverance. Run with perseverance the race set before you, fixing your eyes on Jesus. Now, here's the thing. This is the other thing I would say. Like we're kind of like walking through this text, and one of the things that's going to be easy for us to do is just understand this text as metaphor. As we've said earlier, until and or unless life does not change for me in an embodied fashion, life does not change. Until this becomes a real experience for me, it's not a real experience. So, here's a question. When you hear the phrase, fix your eyes on Jesus, fixing your eyes on Jesus, what's the first thing that comes to mind? The cross? A goal? What else? Focus? I'm sorry? The Word, the Bible? Prayer? Paying attention? Savior? Okay. I'm sorry? Jesus. There are too many people coughing. Could you just stop for a second, please? Jesus. And what do you mean by Jesus? His face. I want to suggest that like we in the West can hear that, and all those words that we've just named are all true, and they all fit. But I want to suggest that I want to invite us to consider that the first thing that we want to have coming to our mind when it comes to this is we fix our eyes on Jesus' gaze as his gaze is fixed on us. How many of us this morning, when we woke up, were we able to wake up and the first thing that came to our mind was the visual awareness of Jesus looking at us? I dare say, like, that wasn't the first thing that came to my mind, right? There's a painting that depicts Luke's gospel's rendition of Peter's denial of Jesus. You've seen it? It's the painting in which Jesus looks, because in Luke's gospel, immediately after the cock crows when Peter denies him for the third time, the text reads, "And Jesus looked at Peter straight in the eye." I don't know if you've read that or not. It looked him straight in the eye. This painting depicts this. And you know, when you look at the painting, it's not hard to imagine that, like, if you're Peter and if you're Jesus, what's going on between them? But I want to, if you were ever to see this painting, I want to invite you to consider this. What if the look that you see in the painting isn't quite that, but would be the look of someone who's looking at Peter and saying, "Just as I said, I know what's happened, but it's okay. I've got this, and I will see you in 3 days." Are we able to see Jesus' gaze not just when we are well, but especially in those moments of our deepest shame? And when we see it, what do we see? Who do we see looking back at us? Because if we do not have an image of a Jesus who is looking back at us and telling us, "I know what you've done. I'll see you in 3 days. We don't see the Jesus of the Bible. This must be practiced. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author of our faith. And how does he do that? Well, we want to say that Jesus authors our faith not by talking about our faith, but by doing our faith. And what's one of the first things that we witness that he does? We're going to have a little exercise here. So I'm going to invite you to put your writing material down. You see, one of the things that we would say that it means to fix our eyes on Jesus is that we don't just see his gaze gazing at us. We also see what he does, and then we do what he does. But one of the things that we see that he experiences is his baptism. And at his baptism, in Luke's version, we hear the text read, "And there was a dove that descended from heaven, and a voice came from heaven saying, 'You are my son, in whom I'm well pleased.'" The voice is a first-person voice. It's not the voice speaking to those around Jesus saying, "This is my son," as you read in the text in Matthew. It's a first-person voice that says to Jesus, "You are my son, whom I love and in whom I'm well pleased." And I want to suggest that this is a text that certainly, surely, tells us something about Jesus. Luke would certainly say that he was intending to write about Jesus. I also want to suggest that this is a text that is telling us something about Jesus' Father. This is a text that is telling us something about God. This is a text that is telling us about a God who looks at you and you and you and me and says the very same thing. We've been made by a God who from the beginning would look at each one of us and say, "You're my daughter, whom I love, and in whom I'm well pleased." It's just that Jesus was really paying attention and then living as if he believed it. So if you're willing, I'm going to invite you at the moment to, we're going to do this little exercise. It's going to take us about 7 to 10 minutes. And I'm going to invite you to just find yourself in a comfortable posture and then allow your eyes to close. Yeah, you feel free if you want to sit down, I mean on the floor, if you want to do that, whatever's going to be comfortable for you. And now, once you find this place of comfortable posture, I want to invite you just to take 2 deep breaths, slowly, intentionally, in and out. And once you've done that, I now want to invite you simply to, in your mind, imagine the room that you're in. Now, it's entirely likely that keeping our eyes closed, 2 things can happen. One is that we can get sleepy, which is okay. If you find yourself getting a little sleepy, you can just open your eyes just a little bit to let in some light. We can also find that our attention will wander. And I want to suggest that when it does, for it will, simply and without judgment, allow your attention to come back to where you are. And so now I want to invite you to just be aware of the room that you're in. You can picture it in your mind. And from there, picturing the people who are in the room who've come to join you. And now I want to invite you to allow your attention to shift to your awareness of your own body and your own space. Recognizing the contact that you have with your feet on the floor, the contact that you have with your seat where you're positioned, the tilt of your neck and your head. Just be aware of that. Not judging it, not trying to correct it, just being aware of it. And now I want to invite you to allow the focus of your attention to shift and move to a different space, a space of your own choosing, a space of both strength and beauty. It could be a space that you've been to before. It could be a place you've never been before. It could be inside or outside, near a body of water, a mountain, a meadow, a field. It could be in your favorite chair, in your favorite room in your house. And it may take a little while for us to arrive at this space, but once you do, I want to invite you to now begin in your mind to look around at that space. Observe it. Be aware of what you sense. Notice the colors. Notice the objects. Notice if you're standing or seated. Notice the ambient air temperature. Notice any aromas. Notice any sounds. Be aware of the elements of this space that bring forth its beauty and its strength. And now I invite you to allow for the presence of God to join you in this space. And God will come as He will. He may come from beside you, before you, behind you. Now I invite you to allow God's gaze to find yours and to be keenly aware of His capturing your seeing Him seeing you. Notice the look on His face. Notice the delight in His eye. And now hear your God say this: "You are my son. You are my daughter. I could not be more proud to be your father. You are my son whom I love, and in whom I am so delighted. You are my daughter, and you are my joy. I can't believe I get to be in the world with you." You are my daughter. No one takes you out of my hand. You are my son. You are my love. And you always will be. You are my daughter. You are the first thing I think of when you awaken in the morning. You are my daughter. You are my son. Don't you ever forget it. You belong to me. Now I want to invite you to notice as you allow for the presence of God to begin to move once again. Moving, but never leaving you alone. And as he has moved, I now invite you to once again look around at this space of goodness and beauty and strength that you and your God have shared, this space to which he bids you return again and again in order for him to find you. And as you do so, I invite you to recall with intention the words you have heard, the visions you have seen, and what you have felt in your body. Now I invite you to allow the focus of your attention to begin the process of moving from this space of strength and beauty, returning to this space that you occupy where so many others have come to join you. And as you do, you will become more aware of where you are seated with your feet on the ground, your posture, and aware of those around you and this space itself. And now, when you are ready, but not before, I want to invite you to allow your eyes to open, returning to this space awake, alert, and attuned when you are ready and not before. So what I want to do is I just want to invite you to offer some single words loud enough for us to hear, some single words that represent what that was like for you. Fulfilled, peaceful, warmth, clarity, wanted, hope, secure, inspired, free, loved, vulnerable, validated, like a child, delight. Unworthiness, overwhelming, found, graced, peace. Now, it's important to know the words. Here's an exercise for you to do. I'm like to do this before the day is done, like before you go to bed tonight. Whatever the words are that you would use to describe that, it would be a helpful thing for you to write them down. It would be a helpful thing for you in your journaling before the next 24 hours elapse for you to write and describe what this experience was for you, where you were, what it was like, so forth and so on. The words are important to help you remember and draw you back to the experience. Jesus gives us an example of what it means for our lives to begin in joy. Our lives were made for joy. We begin with hearing our Father say, I can't believe I get to be your God. Like, it's like the best day of my life. All day, every day, right? These stories of Jesus' baptism were some of the first stories in the New Testament that began to give people notions of a thing called the Trinity. Now imagine this for a moment. Imagine if when this is all done, I don't know, some of you might be here with another person who might be your best friend, but let's say that your best friend doesn't live here in San Francisco. Anybody here have a best friend who lives someplace else? Right? Okay, so a number of you. Imagine when you go home today, at the end of our day, you walk into your apartment or your house, and there's like, for some reason, like the kitchen light is on, and you walk into your kitchen, and there is your best friend sitting there. And of course, you're only like, who died, right? Well, like, why are you here? But like, what if they say like, no, like I was thinking about you this week, and I thought I just got to come be with you. Now, what if it's your three best friends? And they're all like in cahoots, right? And they say like, we started talking, like we knew, like we thought like, hey, when can we do this? And we just like, that's Saturday that they're going to hear that conference thing, or we're going to, hey, let's just show up at her apartment. And you walk in and your three best friends are there, and they say like, we've been talking about you for the last 2 weeks and we just had to come be with you. Would that be a good thing? And they're like, and we've already talked to your boss, you're off work the first 2 days of the week. And we're just going to hang out, right? And we're going to do stuff. We're going to go dancing because we know your boyfriend doesn't want to. Okay, right? Here's the thing. Did we or did we not this morning wake up and see them in our bedroom? Right? This is what the Holy Trinity is up to, right? You wake up and the Holy Trinity is there and you're like, oh, like, oh my God. And they're like, we've been waiting for you all night. Right? This is the thing. We serve this relational God whose mission is to remind us that we are loved from day one and before. Paul says this, for those he's predestined, he's called. This is Romans 8. And those he's called, he's justified. And those he's justified, he's glorified. Here's something to be thinking about. Those he's predestined, it's that word predestination, here's some really important news. God has been thinking about you for a really long time. God is not the parent who, as he thought about your coming into the world, was anxious about it, was worried about it, was distressed that you were coming into the world. God could not wait. He's been thinking about you forever. That's not necessarily where we think about how God thinks about us. He's been thinking about you forever. What he predestined, he's justified. So here's the thing. He's called. You see, it's one thing to know that you're here. It's another thing that once you get here to say, hey, come on, let's go. I want you with me. He's called all those that he's already been thinking about forever once you get here, right? We're called. You're mine. You're my daughter, whom I love, and in whom I'm well pleased. Let's go. Now, here's the challenge. To call us also means he's going to justify us, because here's the problem. Because like when I'm called, the first thing that I recognize is that I'm not very good at answering. Do you dig that? Right? The first thing that happens is like, I want to be pleasing. God says, you're my son whom I love and well pleased. And I love that. And at the same time, there is some part of me that feels my awareness that, I'm not really the guy you think I am. Right? You might think you love me, but I think that you need to talk to one of the other people in the Trinity to get a better idea. You with me? And this is the thing, this whole notion of justification, like, Jesus gets it. He gets it that when he calls us, we're going to have trouble, and he's not worried about it. He's just going to keep calling, and that calling is what we would say is justification. That justification by crucifixion and it's Good Friday and it's Easter. It's all of this. God saying, "You're with me. I know who you are, and I want you anyway." Over and over and over and over. We wonder what heals shame. This is where we begin, because we have to practice paying attention to the face and the voice of God saying, "You're my daughter, whom I love." And in whom I'm well pleased. That's right. But what about what I did last night with my kids? He's like, did you hear what I said? Like, yeah, I know about that. It's very difficult for us to have our attention turned away from our shame toward God's delight. But that is what we are called to practice. This is the work that we do. The work that the rich young ruler could not do was simply turn his gaze to Jesus and away from his work. By his work, I don't mean the work that he does for God. I mean the work that he's doing to prove himself to God, that we're all doing. We're all worried that we're not enough, and we're working our tails off to try to make sure that somebody, for the love of God, somebody, please tell me I'm okay. Those he's justified, he glorifies. Well done. Well done. Like, you got a pulse? Well done. I love that about you, that you're breathing. You look so good just like getting up out of bed. It's such a wonderful thing, right? And that's the thing. The Trinity is waiting for us every day. The question is, are we paying attention to this? And then we move from there. Now, notice we haven't gotten through the whole Hebrews passage yet, right? We move from there in Luke chapter 3, right into Luke chapter 4. And this is the thing that's the next piece of this part about what we do about shame. Because the text reads that the Spirit drives Jesus into the desert, into the wilderness. I want to suggest to us that Jesus did not go into the desert for the devil to find him. Jesus went into the desert to find the devil. He went looking for his own places of vulnerability. He went looking to expose and be vulnerable around those things that he knew were going to be risky for him. You see, Jesus knows that he's got something. Jesus knows that he's charismatic. Jesus knows that he's got power that are unlike other people, other kids in his neighborhood, right? Jesus knows there are things about him that are his greatest gifts, and it is in those places where we are most gifted where evil will come to shame us the most effectively. And so Jesus is going to go and, like, have these be tested, have these be sifted. In fact, he's going to root that out. So we like to talk about this as a shame inventory. Don't you love that idea? Yes, let me make a list of all the shameful things I've done. Because, you see, if the Trinity is in your bedroom every morning, which we would suggest it is, it's also equally true that your shame attendant is also sitting on the other side of the room. And each of us has one. Each of us has our own personal emissary from evil, as it were, whose job it is the moment that I wake up and I'm hearing the Trinity say, man, good morning, good, welcome to Saturday. I hear the shame attendant saying, and you're late again. How many times are you going to hit the snooze bar? And you're like, well, I got to get to the bathroom. And then you go to the bathroom where they have mirrors, right? And the shame attendant, who's already dressed for work, to work for you, right? You're just like, man, like, what are you going to do with that? You know how this goes. And then it's all day, every day. You should have done this. You should have done that. That wasn't done well enough. That wasn't, that's what, I mean, you follow me, right? Again, back to this notion that most of shame happens in terms of our personal experience, in the privacy of our own minds. Now, let's not be, and we saw this last night in John 9 about what happens when shame becomes enculturated, right? John 9 is about a community, right? John 9 is not primarily about a blind guy. John 9 primarily is about the critique of a community that has become corporately shaming. And the blind guy just becomes the victim of that. That's what racism is, right? This is what poverty is. Like, these are these kinds of things where shame has now taken a hold at a corporate level, at a cultural level, and now does things to us tacitly that we don't even know that it's doing. It's subtle, it's smart. And your shame attendant is very, very busy. You know, I tell people, these things are in the privacy of our own head, but, like, if it really were an attendant that you've hired, you'd want to fire them, right? I grew up as an evangelical Quaker, right? So, oh, yeah, well, what's that? yeah, what's that? That's like, I don't know, like that's a, I can't come up with something smart aleck enough to say. What is it? But I say, like, you know, you're shaming them, like you'd want to kill them. Right? You would love to put them to death. But I'm a Quaker and I can't do that. I'd hire a Presbyterian. They could do that. They could do that, don't you think? They could do that pretty effectively. Yeah. The point is this. Jesus has his own personal shame attendant, and he goes to find him in the desert. And the devil says, you know, if you were God's son, like this is a recapitulation of the conversation that the snake has with the woman in the garden. If you really were lovely enough to be God's daughter, he would let you eat of that fruit of the tree. But he doesn't want you having anything to do with him. He knows in the day that you eat thereof, you will become like him. If you really were God's son, if you were, which is really a way of accusing him, it's like, you're not really God's son, are you? Because if you were, you would do this, and you would do this, and you would do this. Can you imagine? What does Jesus say? What's Jesus do? What does he do? It is written, right? It is written. It is written, it is written. Now, here's the thing. If you're a first century Palestinian, if you're a first century Jew, and you say it is written, you're not really thinking about it in the way that a 21st century Westerner would think about it. A 21st century Westerner would think about this as kind of like a magic talisman, right? It's some magic thing we say, it is written, and it magically just like makes something happen. No, for Jesus to say it is written means Jesus is appealing to God's word, which is like saying, it's like Jesus saying to the devil, you say that, my dad says. Right, you get this, right? His life with his father was so intimate that he can say it is written, and he means, like, how many of us like have ever been those places where we need to be able to say to the bully, my dad says if you touch me again, something bad's going to happen. Right? We need to be able to appeal to our parent that can come and say on our behalf, this is what is true. We're not just appealing to some written record, some abstract idea, some theology. No, this is me turning my mind to remembering, you are my son, whom I love and in whom I'm well pleased. Does that make sense? Which means that we heal shame primarily by, first of all, actually, oddly enough, going to find it. So the shame inventory goes something like this. You get some way of recording it, whether it's a 3x5 card. I usually encourage people not to do it on your machine because you can, but a 3x5 card that actually has you having to do something with physical material. And at any point in time during the course of your day, when you start to sense, image, feel, think, or behave in a way that you recognize as having to do with shame, you simply put a mark on your card. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've had people come in, they say, look, by 10 o'clock in the morning, I'd gone through 4 cards. I'd filled the front and the back. Like, and I don't have time for this. Like, I have a job. I have to work. Like, what do you think? Like, I'm it's like, you're the psychiatrist. I'm paying you to fix this problem. I don't think I should have to be filling up these cards. Now, here's the thing. When you find one of these moments, this is the point. The point is not that when, oh, now I have to figure out, like, where did that come from? Why did I do that? No, we're not interested in that so much. Nope. Because that part of me that wants to go back and figure that out and explain all that, that's shame at work. It's saying, like, no, I got to be smart enough. I have to figure this out. I have to recognize. No, what we want you to do is simply pause and turn your attention back to, you're my daughter, whom I love, and in whom I'm well pleased. You're my son, whom I love. And I don't mean just like that as a mantra. I just mean like as a visually experienced exercise in that moment. If you do this exercise that we did today, daily for the next 6 weeks, it becomes part of your brain's cortex. It becomes easier for you to recall and remember just to access it. It's not just something that you then do for 10 or 15 minutes once a day. It becomes what you live and breathe all day, every day. To fix our eyes on Jesus is to see what he did and then do what he did. In Luke's gospel, you see this, right? In the others as well, but mostly in Luke's gospel, you see Jesus is up early and up late, up early and up late, and he's off in some deserted place praying because, as Mark's gospel says, when the tempter left him, when it was all said and done, He left him for another opportune time. Jesus is up early because he has to be paying attention to that father's voice of his saying, like, you're mine, just so you know, you're going into the hornet's nest today. I want you to be paying attention to me and remembering that you're mine, nobody takes you out of my hand. And so when those moments for shame come, we identify them, we keep our friends close, we keep our enemies closer. I want to know my enemy really well in order for the purpose of then turning my attention away from that and toward where my life is to be found. Does that make sense? Now, this is hard to do. It's not hard to do because it's complicated. It's not hard to do because it's got, you know, you got to have a PhD. It's hard because, A, evil does not want it to happen. And in that case, like, we've got all kinds of other things in life that we're busy doing. And if we don't do this work, it will own us. Shame will own us. But if we do it, and if we do it together, and what does together look like? Well, who are your cloud of witnesses? Who's in that cloud? What does it mean if you're going to say, look, once a week, I'm going to get together with these people, and we're going to have a time of confession and prayer in which we're going to name what our shame has been, for the very purpose of being able to celebrate how it has been that Jesus has turned our attention back to him in those very moments. Now, here's what happens neurobiologically. If every time there's a stimulus wherein which I feel shame and incorporate this in 100 billion different ways in my mind, for every time that that happens, wherein now, when that stimulus, I sense it, I'm actually going to turn my attention back to the baptism of Jesus, back to my own hearing that I'm God's son, God's daughter, what I'm actually doing is taking the stimulus and changing its outcome. Are you with me? But it takes practice to take the stimulus and change its outcome. If I had a really bad experience as a four-year-old swimming, if I had a near-drowning experience, and I don't ever go back to the pool until I'm in my 20s or 30s, the way I get back in the pool is not to just go jump in the pool. That's too terrifying for me. What do? I go to the pool, and I start with my street clothes on, just sitting on the deck of the pool. That's all I do. And I'm going to hear the chop of the water and the smell of the chlorine, and my heart rate's going to go up, my pulse rate's going to go up, but I'm going to sit with somebody else sitting next to me, maybe even holding my hand, and they're going to help me relax, breathe, drop my heart rate, and before you know it, the stimulus is actually going to become a stimulus for me being quiet, confident, and composed. Does that make sense? Evil hates this. Here's the thing. When we begin to do this on a regular basis, and it will take weeks for this to take root, and when it does, what will begin to happen is you will start to notice that your responses to shame begin to change categorically. Something else you will also notice, you will start to notice access to acts of creativity that you didn't know you had. And that is because shame has had us so bound up for so long that most of what we've been doing is just managing that as opposed to being open to create as God has called us to create. It's 12:05, and we're going to stop with this part, and we've got one more chunk of time for us, because one of the questions that we still want to get to is, what does this then look like when we start to do this corporately? What does this look like when we do this institutionally and vocationally? What does this look like if I'm working in a software engineering company? What does this look like if I work in a church? What does this look like if I'm a teacher? What does this look like if I'm an attorney? What does this look like if I'm driving a truck? All these different vocational callings. Remember, this is not just about feeling better about ourselves. This is about God unleashing his people to create outposts of goodness in beauty in everything they do.